Well, the question to raise if you're a Democrat is, do the Democrats have what it takes to beat the Republicans? Well, certainly in Congress, they've been losing.
The public needs to think of the word disinformation when they hear these very, very loose phrases like harboring terrorists coming from the administration.
A war on terrorism by the United States is impossible because we're the number one terrorists. It's impossible. Absolutely impossible.
This is a special edition of Pacifica's Peace Watch for Monday, October 6, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. This week on Peace Watch, we're bringing you a series of speeches and interviews from our archives, which we deem to have relevance to events in the news this week. The second half of tonight's show will be devoted to the late longtime peace activist Phil Berrigan, who would have turned 80 years old yesterday. In the first half tonight, we'll talk to consumer advocate Ralph Nader about the California recall election tomorrow and his plans for election 2004. But first, a brief update on the violence this weekend in Syria. Israeli warplanes on Sunday bombed the suspected terrorist camp northwest of Damascus, Syria. Israel alleged that Islamic Jihad in Syria were responsible for a suicide bombing the day before at a seaside restaurant in Haifa. The group Islamic Jihad, in fact, claimed responsibility for the bombing but denied having bases in Syria. At the United Nations today, Israel faced worldwide condemnation for its actions over the weekend. That condemnation came even from the United States, which is typically a staunch ally and supporter of Israel. Speaking with reporters, President Bush said he had told Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon that although Israel has the right to defend itself, it must avoid escalating tensions in the region. Speaking with CNN, Syrian government minister Boutania Shaban rejected claims that her country was harboring terrorists, and she criticized Israel for launching the attack.
Syria believes that what has happened in the last 2 days and what Sharon has done is first to export the crisis he has inside Israel, and second is an evidence of the weak international order. Although after the strike, we are very grateful for all the countries who expressed solidarity with Syria. However, we believe that the United States should take a stand against the Sharonian policy of killing and death and destruction. We really believe that the United States should take a lead to reverse the strategy of war in the region into a strategy of peace. And the United States knows that Syria is a very serious partner for peace, and it has always worked and will always be ready to work for real and enduring peace in the region.
Syrian Government Minister Boutania Shaban speaking with CNN. A source at the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the group whose base in Syria was raided by Israeli warplanes on Sunday, reasserted today that the base had been abandoned for the past 7 years and that the footage of the camp being circulated by the Israeli military was taken from a film made in Syria several years ago. Several months ago, Peace Watch spoke with Scott C. Davis, the author of The Road from Damascus, A Journey Through Syria. The book is a travel log in which Davis shifts back and forth between the Syrian police state of Hafiz al-Assad and the rich cultural heritage underneath this little-understood Arab country. In this informal commentary, Davis shared with Peace Watch his perspective on Syria and the events as they unfold. His work in progress is the second in his series on Syria, Four Freedoms, Syrians Talk About Life in a Time of War, and includes interviews with Syrians from all walks of life.
All of these accusations by the administration are questions on the order of, when did you stop beating your wife? They're intended to rile Americans and to put Syria in a bad light, but they're not really informative questions or questions that are, you know, based on a real picture of the country. You know, the first point to keep in mind is that, you know, Syrians love American culture. They love American ideals. The U.S. government had a hip-hop group from Chicago, I believe, that was a Muslim hip-hop group. When they came to Damascus, it almost caused a riot. The people were mobbed. Syrians are the first to ask the State Department to send American cultural exhibits and cultural exchanges on tour. The fact is that Syrians from the lowest to the highest love America, and they look toward us because we're the people that had the Declaration of Independence. We're the people with the Bill of Rights. We're the people with the Fourth Amendment. And they depend upon us to hold those ideals high. When Syrians are angry with us, they're angry with us because they feel we are betraying the high ideals that are embedded in our most precious documents. The government of Syria is the same way. You know, the quote-unquote dictator who is running Syria happens to be a fellow who's educated in London, who made an inaugural speech in July of 2000 before Parliament in Damascus that could have been written by Thomas Jefferson. The guy is a reformer. He wants civil liberties. He wants freedom of speech. He's released half the political prisoners and is in favor of releasing the rest. He's opening the economy. You know, what would we ask somebody to do that he's not already attempting to do? So I think it's pretty arrogant of the United States to think that here's a country that we can demonize at will. I think that the public needs to think of the word disinformation when they hear these very, very loose phrases like harboring terrorists coming from the administration. Syria, after 1967 defeat to Israel and after the 1973 war, which could also be described as a defeat, found itself with a population that was enraged. They said the Israelis are doing terrible things to the Palestinians. Our government is incapable of opposing them with our army, so we're going to take matters into our own hands. And people began training in camps around Damascus. They began arming themselves, and the idea was that they wanted to infiltrate Israel and commit guerrilla acts on their own to carry the battle on. So the Syrian government clamped down on this and instead threw support behind the Hezbollah and before that by giving office space to different Palestinian groups like the PFLP-GC, Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine General Command. So when the U.S. says Syria is harboring terrorists, they're talking about administrative offices for groups like the PFLP-GC. They're talking about Syrian philosophical support or maybe a little bit of logistical support for the Hezbollah. But what they're really not saying is that both of these things are examples of the way that the Syrian government has actually prevented terrorism and prevented freelance guerrilla activity from threatening Israel. So far as the motive for the current smear campaign, it's got to be pretty obvious that the exact same kind of language preceded the attack on Iraq. So I'm not sure the administration wants to attack Syria. I think they want to demonize Syria, put Syria in a position where Syria feels that it's vulnerable to attack, and then extract whatever concessions suit the administration. So given that Syria's government has power from the poor and the formerly disenfranchised who now have education and positions in government and positions in the economy and in business, many of the policies, for example, the economic policies of the regime, are to keep the price of bread cheap. And so they've sacrificed growth that they could have had and other kinds of economic benefits in order to create a stable life for Syria's families. And probably one of the finest things about this country is the beautiful families, communities, and neighborhoods, and I guess you'd say extended family life that Syrians enjoy, with a very, very low rate of crime, to the point of saying that crime is pretty much non-existent by American standards. So it may be just a little bit of a conspiracy theory to say, what happens when the United States goes into Iraq, takes the suggestion, which was recently voiced in public, actually, by representatives of Israel, that the oil coming to Syria from Iraq should be cut off, and taking that and implementing it. Also, is it really an accident that the Syrian Ministry of Trade in Baghdad that was organizing trade between the two countries was destroyed? Is it really an accident that the oil pipeline between Syria and Iraq, was destroyed. If the Syrian economy can be dismembered by severing its trade relations with Iraq, its largest trading partner, then we have a situation where Syrians are going to be hungry, the economy is going to be poor. In order to revitalize the economy, the regime might have to raise the price of bread. Maybe there are riots in the streets. Maybe the regime has to suppress those riots and start looking like an ugly dictatorship. And then the United States would have evidence on the ground to support its charge that the Syrian government is not particularly supported by its people. Okay, that would be a motive to invade or to crush Syria even more in diplomatic and economic terms. So I think, or at least I fear, what we're seeing is an American attempt to destabilize Syria. And the problem is they have carte blanche to do this because Americans know almost nothing about Syria.
Scott C. Davis is the author of The Road from Damascus, A Journey Through Syria. Well, tomorrow's gubernatorial recall election in California has captured so many of the media headlines over the past several weeks. The candidates finished campaigning today as a new poll found decreasing support for the recall, with 44% saying they will definitely vote to get rid of embattled Governor Gray Davis. As election season heats up both on the national level and within California, Peace Watch spoke earlier today with renowned consumer advocate and political candidate Ralph Nader. We asked for his thoughts about the upcoming elections and his take on the process of recalling a government official.
I've long believed in the initiative referendum recall, direct democracy, which in about 22 states in this country have been their laws for a long time. I don't think, for example, that Schwarzenegger, however, is a better choice than Gray Davis. I think the campaign, instead of being one that explores all kinds of solutions to California's problems and involves a lot of people, has become an overwhelmingly television campaign on both sides and a campaign that's moved from entertainment to farce, where a cyborg actor who ran after everybody in the movies has been running away from reporters and unscripted questions and debates in real life as he campaigns up and down California for the governorship.
So you support recall in general, and I would imagine specifically in this case as well.
I don't support the recall of Gray Davis. I think he's made a lot of mistakes. He's spent too much time raising money from corporate interests and not enough time going around the state meeting with regular people, workers and minorities and farm hands and people who don't often see a governor and don't have a checkbook in their hand. But the alternative is quite worse. I mean, I think Schwarzenegger basically knows nothing about state government. If he was ever asked by a reporter, what's the name of the department that deals with children or deals with taxes, he wouldn't know anything about it. And so he is going to be, in effect, a puppet of whoever his handlers turn out to be. And also, I don't think he's got any answers about the huge economic problems of California, other than to deregulate and take the corporate cops off the corporate crime beat.
There's some interesting information about him that has not really gotten that much attention, and that's the Santa Monica Foundation for Taxpayers and Consumer Rights has just uncovered 34 pages of internal documents from the Enron Corporation indicating that Schwarzenegger met with Enron CEO Ken Lay, as well as convicted stock swindler Mike Milken and others, 10 days after the rolling blackouts that darkened California. And the men supposedly planned a campaign to sabotage a lawsuit that would make the power companies return the $9 billion to California electricity and gas customers as a result of the California energy crisis. Now, that lawsuit was filed privately under California's Unfair Business Practices Act, but was supported by California Governor Gray Davis and Lieutenant Governor Cruz Bustamante. So the best way to sabotage that lawsuit would be to remove Davis and Bustamante from power. Mr. Nader, your response about Schwarzenegger's alleged role in this scheme?
Well, it's something the voters need to know about. He's not talking. He met in private with people in and around Enron, and, you know, he's obligated to tell people what he's up to. Otherwise, what kind of governorship is he going to run? Secret government? Democracy dies behind closed doors.
And when you say he will, in fact, be a puppet of his handlers, is it possible that these are the type of people that will be handling him?
Seems that way. He's been bending over backwards to show how pro-corporate he is, how anti-law and order, otherwise known as regulation, how anti-regulation he is. And he's been talking about being a disciple of Milton Friedman. So you can see the people who are funding him are very much in the corporate world. So it doesn't augur well for tens of millions of Californians who have to work hard for a living.
You, Mr. Nader, and Democratic presidential candidate Dennis Kucinich are holding a major political rally here in the nation's capital tomorrow evening. Many of the issues on the agenda are of particular local importance, such as securing affordable health care for the district's 700,000 or so residents, the push for D.C. statehood, and opposition to the school voucher plan proposed by D.C. Mayor Anthony Williams. But with Dennis Kucinich as one of the main speakers, I suppose this is also a rally to support his candidacy as the Democratic nominee for president?
Well, actually, it isn't. It's a non-political rally, but we invited all the presidential candidates. He just happened to be the person who accepted. We would have liked to see Senator Graham and Senator Kerry and Howard Dean, but, you know, they're busy. They've got other commitments around the country. This is one of 17 people have the power rallies we've been holding all over the United States, from Portland, Oregon to Tampa, Florida, in the last couple of years. They're all described on the website democracyrising.org, but a lot of area leaders who are fighting for things like restoring funds to a crumbling library system, which is a disgrace the way the library has been starved, as well as issues dealing with health care and education. And the above all, to give the people, the District of Columbia, voting rights so they can have their own voting representatives in the Senate and House. They are disenfranchised. This is the only national capital known in the world, in any democracy, that doesn't allow the people who live in a national capital to vote.
And that's a very little-known fact, I would say,
nationwide. They can vote for president, but they can't vote for the equivalent of senators and representatives. They don't have them.
And what kind of feedback are you getting from the people in these grassroots events, specifically about the District of Columbia's political plight, and other issues? What are the main issues of concern?
The main issues are living wage, universal health care, public funding of public campaigns, a fairer tax system that cracks down on corporate tax escapees to Bermuda and elsewhere. Strong environmental health and safety protection issues. Those are the ones dealing with poverty, of course, and child poverty. Those are the main ones nationally. And above all, cracking down on corporate crime, fraud, and abuse that's drained or looted in the last 3 years alone trillions of dollars from millions of workers, small investors, and their pension holders.
And so these are the issues that are on the hearts and minds of the Americans as you travel about the country. Who is the candidate that they think will best address these issues from their perspective? And are you, Ralph Nader, throwing your support behind any of these candidates in the Democratic arena?
Well, I've been urging Democrats to look hard at Dennis Kucinich. I think he's certainly, by all accounts, the most progressive and corporate critical candidate.
More progressive than Howard Dean?
Yes, I think he is. Howard Dean was a middle-of-the-road Democratic governor. One might call him conservative in a number of respects, especially dealing with corporate matters like Walmart going into Vermont. But maybe he's gotten a change of heart and a change of mind. But his record isn't anywhere near as progressive as Dennis Kucinich.
Mm. And Wesley Clark, General Wesley Clark, seems to be mentioned as a strong favorite. What is your perspective on the general?
He looks like a president, as someone said, and he speaks clearly. So he's going to be a force to contend with.
He also is a former NATO commander, and some would say a war hawk.
I guess by comparison with the hawks in Washington today, I guess he's not much of a hawk. The bar keeps rising higher and higher. He is quite critical of the war in Iraq, quite critical that we didn't go to the UN. So he'll speak authoritatively, but, you know, we'll have to see.
What about third-party candidates such as one from the Green Party? I take it you're not really planning on announcing your own candidacy at this late date.
I'm not going to decide until the end of the year, but I do want to fight for third parties having the right to debate, the right to get on the ballot without having to spend enormous money just designed to keep out competition by the two parties in the state legislature. They've been at this now for many years trying to crush the chance of having a chance by third parties. And historically, third parties have given the new ideas. They've been the source of regeneration, even if they've never won.
How viable is, or I guess strategic, is a third-party strategy in an election that many would say is so critical, like the one we're about to enter into?
Well, the question to raise if you're a Democrat is, do the Democrats have what it takes to beat the Republicans? Well, certainly in Congress, they've been losing, even though the Republicans, by their crassness and their greed and their slavish adherence to giant corporate power, should be very vulnerable. They're anti-worker, they're anti-consumer, they're anti-environment, and this hapless Democratic Party still can't seem to win, even in the House every 2 years. They've been losing 94, 96, 98, 2000, 2002. The question is, unless George W. Bush self-destructs by his policies, which seems to be happening in the last 2 months, can the Democrats beat the Republicans unless they have a spillover vote from progressive, just as the Green Party spillover vote elected Maria Cantwell, the Democratic senator from Washington State, and made it 50-50 in the year 2000, which set the stage for Senator Jeffers to switch from Republican to independent, giving the control of the Senate in 2001 June to the Democrats. That's the spillover vote, and that happened several times in 2000. So Democrats have got to think much more strategically, no more knee-jerk. They've got to be multidimensional and see whether the get-out-the-vote of a progressive initiative can spill over where there are no progressive candidates to help the Democrats.
So you don't see Dennis Kucinich as a progressive candidate?
Oh, yes, very much
you
I
do.
See him as a progressive candidate. The problem is that if you are critical of corporations, you don't raise much money. If you don't raise much money, the press doesn't take you seriously. And if the press doesn't take you seriously, they don't report what you're doing the way they did, say, Howard Dean, or John Kerry, the other candidates. And if you're not in the press, you're not higher in the polls. And if you're not higher in the polls, you don't get into the press. So it becomes a vicious circle, which is attributed to the honesty of a candidate like Dennis Kucinich not taking money from the oil companies and the drug companies and the auto companies.
One has to ask, how does a third-party candidate or third-party insinuate itself into this electoral process in a successful way? And when is ever the right time?
If you ask the Democrats and Republicans, there's never a right time. They just want it all to themselves. That's why we call them the duopoly. But I think first the third party's got to have three or four cycles, election cycles, to build. Rome wasn't built in a day. You know, if it gets a foothold in the first cycle and then begins pushing towards, say, a three-way race, if you have a three-way race, but it's not going to happen unless we get an alternative debate commission that opens it up. There's no other way to reach tens of millions of Americans unless you have $1 billion in money for ads. No other way other than being on a debate commission. And we are trying to interest the League of Women Voters to come on a new debate commission with many national groups, citizen groups representing conservative, liberal, on the board of directors in order to replace the private corporation that is now called pompously the Commission on Presidential Debates that was founded and is controlled by the Republican Democratic Party, whose principal purpose is to exclude competitors.
So, Mr. Nader, if Kucinich is not chosen as the Democratic nominee, and he's starting to look a bit like a long shot at this point, still early in the game, though, would you consider supporting a Green Party candidate this time around, or do you think that the prime objective has to be to get Bush out of office?
Well, I think that has to be the prime objective. I just don't feel as confident as some Democrats feel that the Democrats can do it without help. And help means bringing out new voters who are likely to vote against Bush. And the Democrats say they're going to do that, but, you know, they've never been that successful every 4 years because the people who don't vote look at them as just business as usual, politics as usual. That's why you need new initiatives like the Green Party.
And what about running, say, a Ralph Nader as a vice president on a ticket with Dennis Kucinich or somebody like that?
Well, as you say, it's pretty early, and we have to see what the primaries do and what Dennis scores in the primaries, but I think he should be given a chance. He's got a record. It's not just rhetoric. That's why people want to hear what he has to say. This is his first speech in Washington, D.C., since he announced tomorrow, Tuesday, October 7th, at the Metropolitan African Methodist Episcopal Church. That's a very historic church at 1518 M Street in Washington.
Many computer scientists and civil libertarians have raised concerns about the new electronic voting systems that were installed in many precincts across the country in the aftermath of the disastrous Florida elections of 2000, which relied on the infamous punch card ballots, as we all know. These high-tech machines built by Diebold Election Systems do not keep paper receipts of the votes that are cast, and critics charge that their software could theoretically allow hackers or insiders to tamper with votes and thereby determine the outcomes of important elections. Have you looked into this issue at all, and do you share these concerns?
You're quite correct. This could be the nightmare of 2004 elections. No paper record. Computer specialists at Johns Hopkins have noted, for example, that it's easy for hackers to get into the Maryland computerized election systems, so their officials there are busy trying to develop defenses. You know, I don't know why we don't do it the way Canada does it. In Canada, every precinct has no more than 500 voters. Everyone is registered during the census. You don't have to go and separately register yourself. And you go and vote a paper ballot. You mark it with a pen, hand-marked. And by 11 o'clock at night, everybody in Canada knows who won and who lost the elections. Why in the world do we get into these optic this scanner and computerize that with all kinds of unknown pitfalls for fraud or for miscalculations or crashes of the system? Why? Because the companies are very good campaign contributors to both parties, and it's big business, it's big profits. We should learn from Canada.
Okay, Ralph Nader, it sounds like you have earlier left the door open for a possible Nader candidacy and perhaps even a vice presidential candidacy. I don't know. We'll see. But any final thoughts on your part, Mr. Nader?
No, I think we should try to have more rallies all over the country. People have got to meet each other, join together, band together, vote together. Great things have happened in our history when large numbers of people took a little time out and decided to make a difference. Most recently, the Do Not Call registry, for example, or the increasing likelihood that Congress may override some of the Federal Communications Commission's 3-2 vote, allowing more of our television radio stations to be controlled by fewer media conglomerates. The biggest question in this country is whether people are going to have more self-confidence as citizens to reassert popular sovereignty over corporate domination.
Ralph Nader is a consumer advocate and a former Green Party candidate for President of the United States. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.